Smokable medical marijuana is now legal in Florida, but why are some patients waiting? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Today we're talking with Florida's new director of cannabis, Holly Bell. We'll talk about the governor signing into law the end of the ban on smokable medical pot. We'll also discuss the future of hemp and CBD. And we'll take your calls. Call in 800-743-9576 to ask the director your question about medical marijuana. Also, we get an update on a case involving North Miami officer who shot the caretaker of an autistic man. The story made national headlines as it was caught on cell phone video. And a Tallahassee reporter who covers healthcare policy shares her unique perspective on the beat. The 31-year-old battled breast cancer over the past year and has been sharing her story online. Finally, the popular documentary Cocaine Cowboys has been transformed into a stage show. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, this week, Governor Ron DeSantis signed his first law, legalizing smokable medical marijuana in the state. It's been one of his top priorities coming into office, giving legislators a deadline of March 15th to get the bill to his desk. It's one of the many facets of the state's complicated medical cannabis program, which is being overseen by Holly Bell. Last month, Bell became Florida's first director of cannabis. She was appointed by Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried. Bell will also be charged with overseeing the state's growing hemp industry and the massive market of CBD products across the state. She joins us now from Tallahassee, and we welcome your questions for Mrs. Bell. What questions do you have about access to medical marijuana or CBD products? Give us a call, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. Or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial, and you can post your question there. Mrs. Bell, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for asking me.
So the governor this past week signed his first law. It now lifts the ban on smokable medical marijuana. Now, what does that mean for patients in Florida as of this moment?
So what that means is the bill went into effect immediately. And what Floridians and voted on and have been fighting for, the right to smoke it if prescribed by their doctor, will now be there for them. And what will happen next is the Department of Health will make some rules and guidelines for doctors, and then it should be available to the patients.
Now, is it available to the patients, though? I've been looking around. There are people around the state saying they're still waiting.
Correct. It won't be in the dispensaries yet until we have our guidelines to provide to the doctors. Once those are written by the Department of Health, which should be shortly, then it will be available in the dispensaries for our patients.
And in those guidelines, tell me real quickly what you think they should be. I mean, have we not seen other states already do this, that we could just say, this is how it's going to work, this is how it does work, and we can just do that?
You know, Luis, I think the best practice is always to look out and see what has worked well for other states, what has not worked, and take those best practices and implement those. But the Department of Health will be writing those, and we're here to assist and help them any way we can to get that done.
Let's talk about what the medical marijuana industry could look like in Florida. And, you know, again, we've seen ideas of this, we've seen how this works in other states, but I wanted to get a sense from you and what Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried envision for this system. What are the two of you planning to do moving forward?
So the commissioner has always been very vocal and has been a strong advocate for the access to cannabis for patients. And we just plan on moving that vision forward, giving the voters what they voted on and getting patients who are sick and in need access to the medicine and cannabis that they need that makes them better.
Do you see an industry where small farmers can exist, or in Florida, should it be tightly regulated, left in the hands of a few big growers?
You know, the commissioner is also on record of saying that she thinks it's time for vertical integration to change, and that will be something that the legislator will have to decide. But we are a proponent of that, and would be supportive of horizontal integration and allowing smaller growers and vendors to get into the marketplace.
We're talking with Holly Bell, Florida's Director of Cannabis. If you have a question for the director, now's the time, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Mrs. Bell, you're relatively new to the position, so I want to get into some of your background. You came into this position, you were a Nashville consultant in the financial industry. Tell me, how did you transition into the world of cannabis?
So, Lewis, that's a great question. It was a gradual transition. And although my resume shows predominantly working in the financial services industry, on the side for many years, I have been helping people with business plans in the cannabis industry. I think I looked at my first one around 2010, and it was a coworker at a bank who had an idea about going into the cannabis industry in Colorado. And I sat down with him, assessed his plan, talked to him a little bit, interviewed him. And that was the first one that I looked at him and said, I would go do this. And he followed up years later to let me know he was successful. And through the years, somehow entrepreneurial minded people in the industry would find me and ask me to just talk to them and see if they had had a well thought out business plan, which led to me consulting more and more in that industry. And eventually, the last 2 years, I did it pretty much full time.
Now, you did get, and Nikki Fried, the ag commissioner, did get quite a bit of criticism at picking you. That criticism came from longtime cannabis advocates in Florida who felt that you don't know Florida. But have you reached out to any of those critics? Have you talked to them to try to figure out what the differences are and come to terms with that?
You know, I absolutely have, and that's me. I have reached out to all of them, and we've started a dialogue, and I like to sit at the table and hear all sides of the story, and that's how we come to the best resolution and move this industry forward. So yes, I've actually talked to all of them.
What do you tend to hear from people about what they want to see in Florida or what their biggest concern is?
So there are numerous concerns that they have. One of them is that things get implemented. So we're starting to see that with this administration. And that there is a free flow of information from agencies to consumers to people applying for licenses and access to the monetary system, the financial services system, which is another reason I really started consulting in this full time, because I visited a grow years ago and I was talking to all the young people working there and they started to tell me about how they had their finances set up and just in case somebody came and raided the place or wouldn't let them cash a check, there was money here where they could go buy formula diapers for their kids. And it really concerned me and bothered me to a great level. And that's why I started working on consulting and banking the industry and trying to educate people about that.
Again, talking with Holly Bell, the newly appointed Director of Cannabis for Florida. The number is 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. If you have a question, I want to go now to Richard, waiting in Miami. Richard, thank you for your patience. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. So my question is, it seems as though the city of Miami, at least, has not done maybe any planning or much planning in terms of zoning for the different facilities that would develop with the legalization of cannabis. And by that, I mean retail, wholesale, and grow house, which I know is how some other states have handled it. Is that the case? Have they not? And are other cities kind of behind the eight ball on that? And just your thoughts.
All right, Richard, thank you so much for the call. So the idea of zoning, the question of zoning, and how cities are moving forward with this, or are they?
So that's a great question. And what I hear, this was on a panel that we had a conference on last week, and the topic got brought up. The state enacted a law, and then it is left to the local communities to develop zoning and rules and regulations about locations. So that really is left up to the local governments, and that was the choice of our state legislators.
Now, have you heard any concerns about the local government's approach on this, and what kind of questions they're asking about how they should handle this?
So I do hear some concerns about that. Finding a place to open a dispensary by some of the licensees is a challenge. they can go through 2 to 3 locations sometimes and be denied for various reasons. And then there are some areas where they're just not allowed to open shops.
Now, another thing, too, is that you had spent some time working in Denver with a group called Safe Harbor, and this was to bring the cannabis industry and the banks together. And this is a challenge since marijuana is still federally illegal. How do you think this is going to work out here in Florida?
So we currently have 2 banks that bank the industry here, and we I think that is going very, very well for all of our licensees. And I'm very proud of those 2 banks and all they do. They've got great programs, and they're providing great services and getting cash off the streets.
Again, talking with Holly Bell, the newly appointed director of cannabis for Florida. We're talking with Bell about the implementation of the new smokable medical marijuana in the state, as well as the future of hemp and CBD markets here in the state. And we're taking your questions. Again, 800-743-9576. You could post those questions on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Mrs. Bell, the talking about CBDs, the market in Florida has exploded in recent years. And that's raised some concerns with Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried. She wants a seal of approval on all CBD products. Can you speak to how that industry will be better regulated and just remind people what CBD products are?
Sure, I can, Lewis, and that's a great question. And what we've really are facing here in Florida is a time lag issue where the federal farm bill was signed the last week of December, redefining what industrial hemp was, the CBD, which is produced and manufactured out of hemp and sold in various stores around the country. So Florida has not done that redefinition yet, and we're in the process right now that we are in session of getting that done. So what the commissioner's concern is, first and foremost, is the safety of our consumers and make sure that they're buying a product that is giving them what is on the label. Her vision for a hemp program in the state of Florida is one that provides a resource where they can verify through testing that what they are taking out of this product is actually and getting from it is what is actually on the label.
All right, I'm going to go back to the phones again, 800-743-9576. I want to go to Pam in Plantation. Pam, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. I was wondering about growing it. We live in Florida, the sun shines. How about me having a couple of plants in my backyard?
We've had this question before. Pam, thank you so much. I appreciate it. This comes back to also this idea. Is it just going to be the big growers? Do you see a day when people can just grow their own?
So, Pam, are you talking about a cannabis plant with high THC or a hemp plant?
I unfortunately, we've lost the call.
Okay.
But yeah, just basic question is, can someone grow their own in, you know, their own backyard or in their home?
Not under current statute. That is not allowed.
You know, you just mentioned something too, and it's going back to the farm bill. So hemp has been legalized, but there's still an issue with the idea of cannabis itself. And marijuana is not legal, but help us understand how these two are being differentiated.
So the differentiation is that the Delta 9 THC level in a hemp plant is 0.3 or lower. And in a cannabis plant that is high THC, it's higher than that.
And so then again, that is the thing. That's the part of what makes marijuana gives it its what people look for when they want to smoke it or to take it in, given that, you know, the high, basically.
That is what the THC is, correct.
All right. But at any point, again, just to come back to this, is what do you envision the sort of regulations that we will have for the growers and who will be able to grow it?
For hemp?
Yeah, well, for hemp, but also for just for cannabis.
So right now we're focusing on the hemp program. We have a pretty clearly defined statute on medical marijuana. And so on hemp, what I would envision is similar to what other states have, where you have available farmland, you're interested in growing a crop, and you apply for a permit through the Department of Agriculture to get a permit to grow hemp in the state of Florida.
I wanted to go to one of the comments, one of the questions, I should say, from one of our listeners on social media. This one coming from Facebook. Justin Harris had commented in asking this question: how can employers handle employees with their medical card? There are many non-euphoric medicinal varieties that can be purchased, but there are many other very strong varieties that can also be legally purchased. When my employee's clearly stoned at work but has a medical card, what do you do?
Well, you know, that's a great question, and really one that the company is going to have to decide themselves how to set a policy with an attorney. Really not something where we would get involved.
Okay. You know, I wanted to come back to you because you were talking about the hemp, growing of hemp here in the state and starting getting a hemp industry started. There is, you know, Senate Agriculture Chairman Ben Albatron from Wachula has filed a bill. There is a Senate bill and a House bill on this. What sense do you have if there's an appetite in the legislature for this sort of product? Did the people want to go in this direction?
In the product of hemp,
yes.
We have two bills, and they're working their way through the process, which is, you know, committees. They've been filed, then they'll go through committees, and then they'll end up on the floor to be voted on. So we're in the process of going through committees with both the House and the Senate bill currently.
I'm going to finish with this. Just a reminder to folks, again, the governor signed into law that smokable medical marijuana is now allowed in the state of Florida, but patients are still waiting. What do you say to the patients who are still waiting?
To the patients that are still waiting, I'd encourage you to email your representative and or Department of Health or myself and let us know that you would like us to hurry up, and we'll pass that on up the chain. Or call your state senator or representative and let them know that you feel like it's taking too long.
Holly Bell is the newly appointed director of cannabis for the state of Florida, joining us from Tallahassee. Mrs. Bell, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Lewis. Thank you.
And we'd love to hear from you. You can find us again on Facebook or Twitter. Let us know, what is the big concern that you have? What's the big question? Share with us your thoughts, your ideas, because this is a conversation we're going to continue to have moving forward. Well, still to come, what's next in the case of the North Miami cop who shot at an autistic man? That's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, last week, jurors were deadlocked in the case of North Miami police officer Jonathan Alida. Alida made national headlines back in 2016 in the shooting of Charles Kinsey. Kinsey was a caretaker for an adult autistic man, Amaldo Rios Soto. Now, Soto and Kinsey were in the middle of an intersection after Alida thought Soto was holding a gun and it was a hostage situation. The entire event was caught on video and made national news. Well, last week, a jury acquitted Alida on one misdemeanor, but the judge had to rule it a mistrial because there was no unanimous decision on three other charges. Joining us now in studio for more details on the case and the jury's decision is David Ovalle of the Miami Herald. David, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And by the way, we're also going to mention, we're going to talk a little bit about the whole Robert Kraft prostitution case because there is some breaking news in that. But let's stay with this Alida case. Take us back, 2016, Officer Alida confronted Arnaldo Rios Soto and Charles Kinsey in North Miami. But what were Kinsey and Soto doing at the time?
Okay, so Arnaldo Rios is a severely autistic man at the time. I think he was 26, basically with the mental capacity of a child. And he lived at a group home just down the street. And he escaped from the group home and was sort of playing hide and seek with Charles Kinsey, who was his caretaker. And he basically sat down in the middle of the road in a busy intersection and was just playing with a toy truck. Okay, it's a silver toy truck, like a tanker of a truck. And he sort of pointed it at a motorist that was driving by, and the motorist thought it might be a weapon. So she calls 911 and says, "There's a guy here. I think he might be suicidal. It may be a gun." She was a little, she kind of wasn't exactly sure what it was, but the call went out as a man with a gun, possible suicide attempt. So that's what sort of brought the police to this intersection. And then they see, you know, Mr. Kinsey, who is trying to get Arnaldo back to the group home and trying to talk him back into the group home. And then it just unfolds from there in sort of a comedy of really tragic errors.
And Aleda thought that the gun or that toy truck was a gun as well. But is his mistake in that piece of evidence a key aspect of the case?
Yes, yes. And so it's all a matter of perception, right? And so for the state, they charged attempted manslaughter and culpable negligence. Now, if you remember, Aleda is about 50 yards away. A couple of the other officers had already determined that this was not a gun, that it was a toy, and they had radioed it out saying, it's a toy. And they're just about to walk out into the intersection to sort of engage with the two men. Now, just back up, you remember the famous video is Mr. Kinsey is on the ground begging the police officers, "Don't shoot, it's
his
a toy,
hands
it's
are
a
in
toy."
The air.
His hands are in the air. So the officers closest to him kind of figure that out. But Aleda is a ways back, and all of a sudden, three shots ring out, and one of them hits Mr. Kinsey in the thigh. Arnaldo was not shot.
And you talk about the video, and this is really what made it national headlines. How did the footage play in this case?
Well, they played the footage, and they were trying to get the state was trying to get the jury to understand that the totality of everything going on, that he was not a threat, that Arnaldo was not a threat, that Officer Aleda should have seen, should have heard the dispatches and did hear the dispatches, and should have known that this young man sitting in the middle of the intersection with a toy truck was not a threat, and he should not have fired.
Was it clear that Officer Aleda at the time understood that Soto was an autistic man and that Kinsey was the caretaker?
No, and I don't know. He did not believe that, and I don't even think the state did not say that he knew that, because there was no way for him to know that. He did not. Nobody knew until after, you know, the shooting, that that Arnaldo was autistic and that he had problems. Now, the witnesses say, you know, there was something clearly wrong with him. He wasn't really, you know, responding to the officers or to anybody on the scene. He was just sort of oblivious. That was sort of the theme that witnesses kept coming back to, is he was oblivious. But Officer Aleda, you know, he went on the stand and he testified that this was not, you know, that he really genuinely believed that this was a threat, and that he did not realize that you know, the young man was autistic and could not respond to commands.
Did this case in any way change how Miami-Dade County Police deal with individuals with special needs?
Well, it was North Miami Police, not Miami-Dade County Police.
North Miami Police, yeah.
Yes, it certainly raised awareness. Yes, and there's been trainings and stuff that have gone on for dealing with people with autism and also just with mental health issues. Of course, that's been a big push in Miami-Dade for many years. The mental health crisis intervention team, in dealing with these types of situations, which happen all the time. I mean, this doesn't happen, the shooting, but there's these types of encounters in public that happen all the time with people with sort of a diminished mental capacity. This was an important case for the state attorney's office, because this was the first time that they had charged anyone, any police officer, for an on-duty shooting since 1989. And so it was being closely watched and will continue to be closely watched if they decide to go for a second trial.
You know, and wondering, the timing of this case is interesting, because it comes as Palm Beach Gardens police officer, former officer Newman Rogers, found guilty of manslaughter in the shooting of Corey Jones. Did that case ever come up in conversations in the courtroom?
No, and it could not, just by law. They could not, you know, the jury could not know any of the context of other shootings going on in a completely different place. And that shooting up in Palm Beach is sort of a groundbreaking one, because it's the first time in a long time that anyone's been convicted by jury of an on-duty shooting. It's hard. It's very hard for prosecutors to convict police officers in these types of cases, because I think citizens and juries generally give the benefit of the doubt to the police officers in cases in which they're, you know, it's a high pressure situation, and it's, you know, sort of life or death moments in very fast moving situations.
So the judge declares a mistrial because the jury does find him guilty on one count, but not three others.
No.
Misdemeanor? No.
No, they acquitted him.
Acquitted him on one. The other three, it was a hung jury.
Correct. Okay. Correct. And just as a little bit of context, it was a pretty extraordinary scene. The foreperson of the jury actually walked up to Officer Aleda after the trial, immediately after the trial, stuck out his hand and apologized and said, you know, I apologize that we weren't able to clear you, because we really thought that, you know, you shouldn't have been charged or shouldn't have been convicted. And, you know, the foreperson went on to say that five of the six jurors wanted to acquit outright. And that was apparent pretty early on, but there was just one holdout that did not want.
What happens now?
Well, now the state attorney's office has to decide whether they think they can get a impanel a second jury and get convictions on those remaining three counts. That remains to be seen, but certainly the defense is buoyed by sort of what the jury said, and they think they can win at a second trial.
I'm talking with the Miami Herald's David Ovalle. Again, last week a jury was deadlocked on three counts against North Miami police officer Jonathan Aleda in the shooting of Charles Kinsey back in 2016. Let's move over now to this other big story. It's, of course, the story of the prostitution ring up in Jupiter, this one involving a number of very big names, one of them being New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft. How could Kraft's prostitution charges now be dropped? Because that's the latest story.
Right. Well, it was sort of cast when it first came out as this unusual plea offer, which is basically a pretrial diversion program in which someone enters it. Usually they have to take like a values class, maybe do community service, basically admit that yes, they would have been found guilty at trial, and then they enter this program. It's usually like a 90-day program, and then once it's completed, the prosecutors will drop the charges outright. But that was not an unusual offer. That happens in low-level misdemeanors every day in Florida courts, in Miami-Dade, Broward, Palm Beach counties. What the state attorney's office in Palm Beach County was offering was not unusual for a first-time offender and a misdemeanor, low-level case like that. Pretrial diversion is absolutely routine and standard in Florida.
You know, the arrest has raised the profile of Cindy Yang, the former owner of the Asian Day Spa, where Kraft was arrested. I understand Democratic congressional lawmakers want to investigate her now.
Yeah, and that's just been a sort of a crazy spin-off political story from this whole thing. I mean, you know, Kraft himself and sort of what happened there is only tangentially related to this interesting only in Florida character that we have in Cindy Yang. But I think as far as the criminal end, I think it really has cast a spotlight on sort of this unique massage parlor industry and the human trafficking and sex trafficking that many in law enforcement believe is going on in these places all over the country.
Again, talking with the Miami Herald's David Ovalle on these two stories and stories that we'll keep our eyes on if anything else does come up. David, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Much appreciated.
All right, still to come, we're going to hear the story of a young healthcare reporter battling breast cancer. All that next here on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. There are times in life where our professional lives and our personal lives intersect in unbelievable ways. Politico reporter Alexandra Glorioso has been covering healthcare and health issues statewide in Tallahassee. Last summer, the 31-year-old reporter received a diagnosis that's hard to imagine for her age, stage 2 breast cancer. Instead of leaving work for treatment, it became a part of her job. Alexandra's story last summer, "I'm coping with cancer by reporting on it," exploded online. For months, she tweeted about her treatment, her dealings with her insurance company, and funding for hospitals. Last week, Alexandra tweeted, quote, "Hi, my name is Alex, and I'm officially cancer-free." WLRN reporter Jessica Bakeman is in Tallahassee on assignment and sat down with Ms. Glorioso in her home. She learned about her experience of reporting on a subject so close to home.
Alexandra, first of all, I want to say congratulations on your news. You are now cancer-free.
Thank you. It feels really good. And I did get some pushback online, so I feel like I should clarify. I have no evidence of disease at this time, but you can always get cancer again. But it feels like I'm cancer-free because there's no more tumors in my body.
Can you start by taking us back to the summer of last year when you got the diagnosis from your doctor? What was going through your mind in the early stages about how you're going to approach this impossibly difficult period in your life?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I think the first 3 weeks to a month of your diagnosis is one of the most difficult periods. Well, I mean, first of all, I didn't even believe that I had cancer until they told me I definitely had cancer. And I put it off for several months. I felt my first lump in my left breast during session, the last legislative session of 2018. But, you know, I'm 31 years old and I just dismissed it. And I know a lot of lumps in your breast are nothing. And so I blew it off, and I actually only went to the doctor because I needed to replace my birth control. And by the time I went, they felt a couple different lumps, and then after that, it all moved very fast. And at every stage of that process of diagnosing me, doctors were very serious with me in Tallahassee and encouraging me to find an oncologist, and I had no idea what that meant. And I'm a healthcare reporter, so I technically know what an oncologist is, someone that treats cancer, but I didn't know like what the process was to go find one.
What made you decide to document and even report on your experience like you did in that article for Politico magazine right after you were diagnosed, and then also you've continued to share your experience on Twitter?
I think in the beginning, I made a decision that I didn't know how much I was going to be working. And so I'm a healthcare reporter for Politico Florida. I work in the State House for that bureau. And I cover healthcare and insurance and all the policy and politics related to those areas. And at first, I was thinking I should just tell my readers that I'm sick, because I don't want to have this conversation 500 times a day, and I don't know what my presence is going to be like. And so I thought just writing about it for the magazine would be a really good way, I guess, to tell everybody, because it goes further than just putting it in my newsletter or just tweeting about it. It was really for me to tell my sources what I was going through. And then when it, you know, that magazine article kind of went viral, and I saw my uncle was emailing me. He gets some like weekly digest of top stories from some aggregator, and it was on there. And my family was reading it from their own news outlets, and they were just really surprised. And I was surprised that it did so well. And I think it's because a lot of people have cancer, and they feel like there's like the advocates of cancer, but it's not a thing that you talk about.
What kind of response did you get from people online, like other people on Twitter, I guess?
Yeah, I got a lot of really interesting responses. I think the biggest thing that I realized is that as soon as you get a disease like cancer, you have it for life. That's why advocates get so surly sometimes when, you know, people like me who have, you know, more of a platform, say cancer-free, in a sense that I perceive myself as cancer-free, and I don't like to think about myself in remission because maybe it's just stubbornness, but I don't believe that I'm going to get this disease again. There's a chance I could. There's, you know, a recurrence. Statistically, I could get it again. and especially because I'm young, my treatment has not absolved me of the disease. I think a lot of people who are struggling with diseases that are not well understood have to turn to each other to get tips and to get information and to learn about different treatment programs that are only being offered in specific places. Because what a lot of people don't realize is that, you know, our healthcare system puts a lot of the burden and choice onto the patient because it's just such a personal decision. You know, it just takes over so much of your life, like how to get treated and how to stay in remission. And there's so many different ways that you can go about that. And I just think that they need more support than they're getting from their doctors or from their family members. That world that opened up to me after writing the first essay was really incredible. And it included journalists, lawmakers, lobbyists, regular people, bloggers, so many people.
So it sounds like you got support, but you also got some pushback or maybe some criticism. Did you ever experience any harassment? I mean, that's something that women deal with online in general and women reporters, especially on Twitter. And given that you were offering so much personal information about yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I put my DMs open for the first time to get stories from other cancer patients and to share tips and to talk with them. And of course, there's like the people who want to get married and who want to
marry you.
Yeah, they're like, hi, my name is so-and-so, and, you know, I'm looking for a wife, or, you know, do you want to get married? I mean, those people aren't that much. And then there's just other people that are like, bless you and your journey, and my name is so-and-so. And
I'm speaking with Alexandra Glorioso, healthcare reporter for Politico Florida, about her experience battling cancer over the last year. She shared her journey through her reporting and on social media. Viewing the process through the lens of a healthcare reporter, what problems did you see with the process of receiving healthcare, navigating insurance?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because as a state capitol reporter, I look at healthcare in terms of budgets. You know, a large part of my job is to figure out, you know, where money is going and how it's being spent in healthcare. And you hear about all these programs like, you know, we give Moffitt, where I got treated, Moffitt Cancer Center, like $60 million a year in state money. And we've tied it to the fact that they have a national accreditation. And I just always kind of looked at that as, you know, a special interest before. And then suddenly when I got sick, and this is not a plug for Moffitt, but it's just what happened, you know, everyone told me to go to Moffitt. And I've heard stories about people getting treated other places. And, you know, just as a patient, I was so grateful that I made a decision to take that advice and go, you know, far away and go somewhere where I get all of my, you know, I get all my treatment in the same place. And you don't realize like how many different doctors you need before you get treatment. Like I need a radiation doctor, a surgeon, an oncologist, and all those doctors have their own tests, their own reports. You know, I could be going to three different hospitals for all of that stuff. I know a lot of women who, for breast cancer, get their main treatment in Tallahassee, where I live, and then they go to Gainesville at Chan's for a different hospital, specialty hospital, for their chemo, or they'll go there specifically for surgery. And as a patient, I just feel like that would be so cumbersome and so overwhelming, and I didn't feel like I had time to navigate all of that. And so it was worth it for me to drive 5 hours a week each way to Tampa to get treated so that I didn't have to do all of that administrative stuff. Like, treating a long-term chronic disease is an administrative nightmare. And now I understand why people talk about continuity of care, which is a really unsexy term, but it means basically that we need all the doctors to be on the same page about this patient. And when they're not, that's when they make mistakes and that's when people get hurt.
There was a point when you tweeted about how your insurance company had denied an expensive test that your doctor said you needed. And then I believe you ended up being able to get that test, maybe in part because of your platform as a reporter. And I was just wondering if you could reflect on that, the power that you have that some other cancer patients might not because you're so visible.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a real challenge for me to navigate that. I did tweet about getting an insurance, getting a test I really needed denied. And I was really frustrated because I had gotten other tests denied. And actually, I just got another test denied. So your insurance company denies tests. I mean, that's just like part of the trick. And what I didn't know before is that you can get them to overturn these decisions, but it's just a hassle. I got a really crucial test denied. It was an MRI before surgery, and to pay out of pocket was going to be like $4,000, which is just money I don't have. And I kept calling Moffitt and trying to get it sorted, and you know, it just, I was getting the runaround and I couldn't figure out what to do. And so I tweeted about it, and then very quickly it got sorted out. And you know, I just realized that it's like I have to be conscious about that kind of thing because I can't, like, you know, for instance, go and reach out and say, I'm a journalist, you must fix this problem for me. And I didn't even realize when I was tweeting about it that it would get fixed. But now I'm like aware of that. And so it's this bizarre kind of ethical thing where even if I'm frustrated, I have to be conscious that I could be treated differently.
How has this experience changed your reporting, or how will it change your reporting on healthcare going forward?
Well, I think the biggest thing is just that I have a familiarity with being a patient that I didn't have before. I mean, I was a young person covering something that mostly affects older people. And I think that it was just such a foreign experience getting sick. And now, you know, I get my labs taken all the time. And one of them last time said I might have high cholesterol, which I never considered, you know. And, you know, there's just a lot you're not prepared for. That you're like, if I have high cholesterol, it's hereditary. And because I'm a healthy person otherwise. And so there's just a lot you don't expect, and I don't think anybody ever expects to get sick. And then when they do get sick, the fact that it's so tough to figure out how to get treated, I don't think I had enough empathy for how difficult that is before because I didn't understand it. And now when people complain about that, I really get what it means.
That was WLRN reporter Jessica Bakeman talking with political healthcare reporter Alexandra Glorioso from Tallahassee. You can see Alexandra's story for Politico Magazine and follow her on Twitter by going to our social media, WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, a return of Cocaine Cowboys, this time to the stage. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Miami New Drama is presenting a play called Confessions of a Cocaine Cowboy. It's based on the documentary Cocaine Cowboys, which was directed and produced by Miamians Billy Corbin and Alfred Spellman, and chronicles Miami's drug wars of the 1970s and 80s. The documentary follows the life of drug lord Jorge Ravi Ayala and drug queen Griselda Blanco. The play looks at Ayala's deposition in the case United States of America versus Griselda Blanco. Billy Corbin has been working with award-winning Miami playwright Oren Squire to bring the story to the stage. Now, this marks Corbin's first time working in theater, and we talked to him about the experience.
The cast is preposterously talented, really elevating the material. But I collaborated on the script with Oren Squire, local boy made good out of Opa-locka, who is now an extremely successful film and television writer on the first season of NBC's This Is Us. And he's written 30 plays, all of which, I think, take place in Miami and has never been produced in Miami before. And now Miami New Drama is writing that wrong. Not only did Michelle, the executive director, the co-founder and the director of this play at Miami New Drama, did he pair us up, but he's also producing one of Warren's plays next season as well. It's pretty fascinating
this
stuff.
This is extra information you found when making the movie. You found research, right, on Jorge Ayala, the hitman, and this is really based on him.
Well, the original inspiration was when we were researching the documentary in about 2004, the first documentary, Cocaine Cowboys. My producing partners, Alfred Spellman and David Sipkin, traveled to Central Florida to obtain this nearly 1,300-page series of depositions. I think it was 7 volumes that Ayala had given in the state of Florida versus Griselda Blanco, which was essentially 3 capital murder charges against her in Miami-Dade County at the time. And we obtained this. We all read it. And I remember, you know, I went to school at New World School of the Arts High School studying theater. And I was, you know, had recently been out of high school and remember reading all these plays. And I was reading this depo going, holy cow, this would make such a riveting play, a one-man show, because it read like this incredible monologue, or even if you just did it love letter style, where actors are sitting with the depo on stage and they just read through it. I mean, this would just be hours of riveting theater, and I kind of filed that idea away in the back of my mind, and then we, of course, conducted a series of our own interviews on camera with the hitman, with Jorge Riviala, and using those depositions, using the transcripts of our own original interviews from the documentary, including a lot of information that we obtained off camera or that never made any of the documentaries, we decided to do this play. It has 7 cast members, each one just more incredible than the next, and playing a series of real life characters and people and politicians locally in Miami. And that's really the thing about it, is that Michelle Hausman, the director of the play and the co-founder of Miami New Drama, said to me last year, he said, Billy, why are we doing Cocaine Cowboys as a play in 2019? And that was like a rhetorical question to challenge Oren and I as to why we were doing this, taking on this folly. And I had an answer. I said, I know why. I said, when you strip away the drugs and the money from the story of Cocaine Cowboys, what it's really about is immigration, children, and gun violence. And what could be more relevant to the conversation in America today?
The other thing I was thinking about too is this. I mean, you know, people who don't know, they haven't lived here, they don't know Miami. A lot of times maybe their perception of Miami is the past. How much Miami should hold on to that history? Should it try to run from that history? How much of it is part of what we are anyway?
And yet, we still hear the last name Carollo and Suarez and Regalado and De La Portilla. So you say it's such a different place, but yet the more things change, the more they stay the same. And so I think the important lesson of history is that we are hopefully not doomed to repeat it as long as we are aware of it. And more importantly, as I said earlier, the Miami of today is the America of tomorrow. So what lessons can the rest of the country and the rest of the world learn about what it is that we've experienced and endured, in some cases survived, in many cases thrived after, and in many cases have failed to learn from our mistakes?
That is director and filmmaker Billy Corbin. We spoke with him earlier this month about the documentary Cocaine Cowboys, which he is now turning into a play. It's called Confessions of a Cocaine Cowboy. It's presented by Miami New Drama. The play is running until April 7th at the Colony Theater. You can find more information about the play on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, that is the program for today, this Wednesday, March 20th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.